Hello and welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, your weekly cybersecurity news and threat research podcast that's brought to you by ReliaQuest. My name is Chris. I'm delighted to be a host. And this week I'm joined by my colleague, Marken. How are you doing, Marken? You okay?
Doing good. Yeah. Been a busy week. I'm sure we'll dive into some of the things.
How's things in the world of detection research? Has it been super, super chocker for you?
I mean, the whole Palo thing is at the moment is the sort of top of mind item. But we've got some projects going on internally as well that have kind of been put on pause for this. So just trying to spin all the plates at once.
Yeah, well, we're going to be getting onto that shortly. So, just as Marken was mentioning, the topic threat du jour, if you like, for this week is going to be a big vulnerability affecting Palo Alto. Did you call it Palo Alto? Palo Alto?
I call it Palo, yeah.
Palo. We'll go with that. Palo. Okay. Yeah. It's so many things with pronunciation, isn't there, in our industry? Like, I had this argument with my friend the other day on SIM versus SIEM, and I was like, no, it's a SIM. And he was like, no, it's SIEM. Anyway. We're going to be talking about this big critical vulnerability affecting Palo Alto. We're also going to be talking about VPN access and the sort of various threats facing virtual private networks. And then we're finally going to be ending the podcast by discussing the latest from the Optum Change Healthcare debacle that happened back in February and the latest developments that are affecting that particular breach. So quite an interesting episode we have ahead of you today. So as Marken was just mentioning, in the last week, there's been a pretty critical vulnerability divulged by Palo Alto. There's actually... this particular bug, which is tracked as CVE-2024-3400, that's now been addressed by Palo Alto, can't even say it, who've released hotfixes to address this particular critical security flaw that impacts the PAN-OS software. This particular bug has been under active exploitation in the wild. So as I mentioned, you know, Tractor's 2024-3400, this has a CVSS score of 10, the maximum that you can get. And it's a command injection vulnerability in the global protect feature that unauthenticated attackers could weaponize to execute arbitrary code with root privileges on the firewall. So this bug reportedly only impacts Palo Alto 9 PAN-OS firewalls that are configured with the Global Protect Gateway or the Global Protect Portal, or both, of course, that have device telemetry enabled. So that's the kind of situation with those particular firewalls. So with that in mind, Mark, and this is CVSS 10 is no small fish. Obviously, we had... You know, quite a reaction to this on Friday afternoon, typically. They always come out on a Friday, it seems. How did we respond to this particular bug for our customers?
Yeah, so from the ReliaQuest perspective, we have a pretty well-defined process when we're dealing with these like high-impact vulnerabilities. Because what we look at is, you know, ease of exploitation, you know, requirement for authentication or not. Can it be exploited externally, or do you need some degree of access already? So this pretty much ticked all the boxes, which is why it has the score of 10. So the way our process works for dealing with these vulnerabilities being disclosed is all three branches of our threat research team kind of has their own tasks, and they work on their own as well as in tandem with other branches. So our threat intel team starts scouring all the sources that they have available, open or closed, try to look for any IOCs that they can glean and feed into our threat enabled rules, which are powered by our intel feeds. And we have two different categories as well. One is where we just collect all the IOCs from different feeds, but we also have an emergency one that's curated by us. So this is, for example, where we saw the Palo Alto signatures that they released after the disclosure. We had those added into our signature emergency feeds that then are live in all of our customer environments and is really part of our sort of initial package that gets pushed when customers onboard with us. And then something that Threat Intel also does with detection research is we try and scour for any indications of proof of concepts, because we want to start understanding as soon as possible how is this vulnerability exploited, because then from there we can kind of pivot into some of the R&D portion to look for detection opportunities, to look at active exploitation in our customer environments. So that's threat intel and detection research. Our threat hunting team first starts off by gathering the scope of customers who have Palo Alto in their tech stack, who use Global Protect as their VPN gateway, and then kicks off global hunts, first for any IOCs, and then as time develops and as the situation develops, we also move into looking at some like indicators of activity and hunting for any retroactive exploitation that we can then call out to the customer. And then throughout this whole process, detection research is looking at any indicators of activity that get either brought up in research documentation or analyzing the POC ourselves. We start kind of thinking about the feasibility of what sort of telemetry do we have available, what sort of information can we get from the tools, and how can we bake that into a detection that isn't strictly IOC related. And then obviously from a communication standpoint, you know, our customers have access to the intel portion on our gray matter platform, where intel updates are posted constantly of things that we uncover. You know, we mention what patches are released, you know, where they can be found, as well as any detection capabilities that we've developed or are monitoring, and all of that sent to our customers as new information gets divulged. And if any hits are seen in the global hunts, then there's going to be direct and prompt notification to the security teams that they have.
Great stuff. That's really good to hear, Mark, and that we have this three-pronged approach to tackling this particular vulnerability. So obviously, TI team, which of course I'm a member, you know, gathering as much intelligence as we can, you know, related to this particular vulnerability, you know, the proof of concept that's in the wild, the active exploitation, you know, who the group is targeting this. You have your team kind of making custom bespoke detection rules related to the particular vulnerability. And then you have our threat hunt team going out and actively searching on, you know, customer environments, trying to identify, you know, said active exploitation to put those customers in the right place and respond in the most timely fashion. So really good to hear we have this, you know, three-pronged approach. Always good to make that clear for listeners to the podcast, of course. So obviously this has been active exploited. That's something we know. What do we know about the groups, you know, targeting, and what's the risk associated with them?
Yes. Yeah, so based on the research that's been conducted across the industry over the course of this vulnerability being disclosed, the one group that's been getting a lot of mentions and attribution to this is being tracked as UTA-0218. They're a group that's been active for quite a number of years now, but have shown a lot of sort of strategic targeting in their campaigns, as well as a lot of quite high levels of skill, especially when it comes to exploiting these high profile vulnerabilities. There is a degree of suspicion that they may likely be state sponsored, just because of how their targeting aligns with certain geopolitical goals, as well as like national security interests, and just the advanced levels of technique and ability that they show is really more aligned with high levels of investment and talent. So that's sort of the quick overview of the group. In terms of the risk that they pose, based on their previous targeting, I would say any organizations that are in like telecommunications, defense, energy, or government sectors, especially in like North America and Europe, these would be typical targets that this group would be going for. Their typical MO has appeared to be revolving around long-term espionage. So they're looking to get into the environment and basically exfiltrate large volumes of data over an extended period. Obviously, this makes detection a little bit more difficult because they do like to deploy capabilities around especially persistence and lateral movement that are quite difficult to detect. So they've been seen using memory resident malware, which don't necessarily have as much signatures and kind of rely more on the living off the land binaries that we've discussed in the podcast before, as well as relying more on stolen credentials rather than brute forcing or compromising themselves. So I think that's where the risk comes from. They're a highly capable and very specific in their targeting. So I think that's where the biggest risk comes from when it comes to this group.
This is a PLC aligned threat group, obviously state aligned group, Chinese aligned.
Well, see, that's the thing, like trying to see what actual country they're aligned with, it gets a bit murky. I think there's more information available, but it's being kept quite close to the vests. But they could very well be affiliated to China.
I came across the same thing as you there. Like, I'm just reading an article as you were kind of going through it there, and it didn't seem to be a specific attribution, which is quite interesting in itself. But you know, just what you mentioned on maintaining that long-term persistence and data exfiltration, that kind of immediately, that's what I would think is like, this is a PRC-aligned group. But interesting to see that that's not being made, you know, overtly public. I guess the last thing to mention is obviously this has been, like I say, one of the highest risk vulnerabilities that I've seen, you know, since the turn of the year. You know, what should listeners be doing at this time other than patching? Well, I've taken one off you there, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, like, for this particular group and this particular risk, obviously we're talking about vulnerabilities. So, you know, the age-old patching management is always going to be the number one thing because it removes the vector as a whole. But, you know, additionally looking at having advanced detection capabilities, because for this group especially, because they like to employ this low and slow type of methodology, because they have that time and resources to sort of hang about in your environment for longer periods, having some of these advanced detection capabilities that look for anomalies and behavior-based activity that might be slightly outside the norm is really going to help you out here. You know, some of these, just based on experience, can be quite noisy. So they will have to be tuned quite heavily to your organization. But, you know, more and more tools are coming out now that do these UBA type alerting. So that's definitely one thing to look at here. And then, of course, just improving the security posture in general, you know, network segmentation is going to be key here, especially for the lateral movement parts. You know, making sure that there's some sort of there's difficulty or there's barriers from being able to move across the network. You know, typically your initial compromise vector is not going to be a critical server or something along those lines. So having that segmentation is going to help with that initial pivoting. So yeah, I'd say those two things working together, as well as obviously the patch management stuff.
Yeah. Network segmentation and obviously privileges, things like that, making sure that people are authenticated to access parts of your network that they need to do the jobs and not above and beyond that, so it doesn't get out of hand unnecessarily. I do love the phrase you just used there, by the way, low and slow. I love that.
Yeah.
I think we should get more cooking analogies into cybersecurity. That's something I can get on board with, I think.
So. Oh, it's one of the banes when it comes to detection, because like all the customers, you know, obviously customers want to detect everything. Right. But sometimes you just got to hold your hands up and be like, look, they took a week to do this one thing. And it's just, you know, if we try and detect that with all the other environmental noise that you have going on, you know, we're sending you hundreds, if not thousands of alerts a week, and we just cannot manage that. So
is expectation management, is that a huge part of his job, would you say?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's, see, organizations are going to have different degrees of risk tolerance. So there's a degree of, you know, how many false negatives are you willing to accept to reduce the level of false positives that you're getting? Every company is going to be different. Some might be very like, you know, we want to see everything and we have the team ready to handle that, which in that case, you know, more power to them. But, you know, other teams, their security team might not be as, you know, mature or robust. So they have to sort of tailor that risk tolerance more for that team.
Just tell me about the worst things that happened that you've it proved to be a false positive several different ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember some of the conversations I had at Exponent were much along those lines. It's like, what's your risk tolerance? And answers varied. Let's move on to the next topic related to a spotlight report. So a piece of research that has been released by our team in the last week, or will be released, I believe, tomorrow. This relates to VPN access. So obviously, one of the big things we've observed and we have talked about on the podcast affecting a lot of different organizations across multiple sectors, geographies, is threat actors exploiting vulnerabilities and weak controls that are inherent in publicly facing virtual private networks. This is done to gain unauthorized internal access with widespread exploitation of vulnerabilities in VPNs. Like I say, you know, something that's just, you know, pretty commonplace across every sector and geography, you know, whatever organization you might be a part of, you know, VPN is going to be something widely used. So it's going to be, you know, of interest to threat actors and groups trying to get that initial access. Go on.
Look at Global Protect now from Palo. Like that's a VPN gateway. Yeah, so
exactly.
They kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. We couldn't have found a better example if we tried, to be honest with you. Right. So, and several other vulnerabilities we talked about this year. You know, your Avanti, Fortinet, you know, all the above, Cisco. This is the kind of thing we see a lot of. So obviously, once they gain initial access and, you know, compromise those systems, they can conduct further enumeration, network discovery, account discovery, brute forcing, and then attempt to move laterally as well. So our research report just kind of covers some of the information, insights related to VPN attack surface management, sort of common threat actor techniques, and then recommendations that we have. So obviously I've just mentioned a few things there, Mark, but what were the sort of key points that you pulled out from this particular report that we put together?
Yeah, when I read the report, I think the first key point that kind of like drove home to me, and it's one of the more obvious ones, but just the way that the attack surface has kind of evolved to increase quite a bit in scope. You know, at this stage, we're all pretty much in this post-COVID era where, you know, everyone was remote and worked from home. But you can definitely see how a lot of organizations have kind of shifted, even post-COVID, to allow a lot of remote work and work from home programs for their employees. So that VPN infrastructure either has been kept after the initial lockdown periods, or it's been sort of brought in to help, you know, maintain talent and things like that. So, you know, seeing how a lot of organizations have shifted to that, it's kind of clear that, you know, a lot of the attack surface and things that have been targeted by threat actors will also kind of fall in line with that. Just based on the report, looking at the RQ customer base, I think the report mentioned that there was roughly 45% who are currently actively logging their remote access tools within a SIM solution or a data lake. And it just goes to show, like, I believe our customer count's well above 1,000 at this stage. So even from our customer base, you can see that it's basically 50%. I think the second key point, if I was to mention it, is there's definitely things that can be done internally to kind of monitor and gauge your levels of susceptibility for attack. You know, you can actively kind of perform these retrospective deep dives to some of the attack surfaces that you have, either external or internal. I think the report goes into great detail about a lot of the different components, but just for any listeners, as a high level point, you know, it goes into like account reviews, looking at some of the additional authentication measures that are working in tandem with the VPN, any sensitive data exposure, and looking at site-to-site VPNs, touching on both external and internal. So there's also, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There's things that you can do proactively to kind of mitigate the impact. And then I think kind of falling in line with that, the sort of third key point that I took away was definitely the forecast. Like whenever I read the spotlights, the forecast is always what I'm kind of interested in, just to see like how are we predicting things to move forward. And, you know, there was some good information about how some new infrastructures and frameworks, especially like Zero Trust, are coming in to try and sort of plug some of those gaps that the current market sort of dominators in VPNs have. But still, like when we even see from our customer base, while Zero Trust is becoming a hot topic in terms of acquisition, it's definitely not adopted nearly as much as it should be. So, you know, for the foreseeable future, you're probably going to still see this threat persisting.
Zero Trust was the hot topic, I think, like 12 to 18 months ago. I remember just all the time, it was just the de facto recommendation. And we talked about this with Rick recently, and I was just like, I think I asked the question, something along the lines of, how are you seeing this adopted among the security leaders that you speak to regularly? And I think the answer was, well, something we're aiming towards. But if you haven't got MFA enrolled on all of your external facing like hosts, then I would worry about that first rather than what seems to me a hypothetical model of getting to this Zero Trust model. But
yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because I felt like I had the same experience with like DLP. Like a lot of organizations were aiming for DLP, but there's so much that goes into it from like the classification side of things. And it's almost always like, yeah, we're aiming to have DLP, but you know, it's there's like a year or 2 years, 2 years out, just because there's so many hoops to jump through.
The remote, going back to what you said at the start, just around like COVID, I mean, we forget that was only a couple of years ago, right? I completely forget about this all the time, and what impact that had on working practices, just in that these companies had to, it was like a boom and bust thing, right? They had to very quickly transition from, in many cases, a completely in-office kind of model to, we need to stand up all of this remote working kind of infrastructure, otherwise our company goes bust. And then since people have returned to the office, largely, I imagine there's a lot of remote work. Well, there is a huge amount of remote working and hybrid working that is ongoing. But most companies seem to be recommending their employees go back to the office, where possible. Maybe some of this kind of infrastructure that was set up during COVID is being, not managed as well as it was, a couple of years ago, perhaps, or otherwise it's just, it's been left to the wayside. So there is those considerable risks. Just to go through some of the common attack techniques that we observed and we mentioned in the report, so I can go through a few of these. So they essentially can be defined as either under the pre-access stage or post-access. So what we mean by that is obviously whether an actor was, already established a foothold on a host and kind of compromised that VPN device. Pre-access, you're looking at, attempts at enumeration and discovering VPN login portals, looking for portals that are unnecessarily exposed to the public internet, and simple tools like your Shodan, Census, that can accomplish this. At this point, they can obviously attempt to conduct account takeover, either through stolen credentials or like credential stuffing, whatever you want to do. And then pre-access techniques also include, rudimentary but surprisingly effective techniques like password spraying that can be successful if directed towards a misconfigured or an insecure device. So we talked about this recently, like even the likes of Microsoft amazingly were successfully targeted by a password spraying attack on a mismanaged and susceptible portion of the external facing infrastructure that just, I assume, didn't have like sufficient logging, like wasn't being monitored. And for me, I just found that astounding. Like if you get targeted by a password spraying attack, that should be setting off every alarm bell going, but it can be successful. And of course, threat actors can also target identifiable and high risk vulnerabilities, just like we were mentioning at the start of this particular segment. We talk about Ivanti, Fortinet, Citrix, often being the sort of usual offenders with these big exploitable vulnerabilities that are being targeted. And then post-access, they can attempt to bypass measures that we would highly recommend in reducing your attack surface. So, I'm repeating you over and over here, Mark, but network segmentation. So they might gain access to a critical system like your domain controller. Our team in this report has identified that we've observed adversaries exploiting such unrestricted access for kind of internal discovery, lateral movement and establishing persistence. and also credential dumping. In some cases, we witnessed threat actors lying dormant to perform discovery within environments. So again, this is your low and slow. That's what we're going to name this podcast, by the way, low and slow. I like that. You know, using the access they have for continuous discovery actions. And it just helps your attacker map information on internal networks, valid accounts, other available resources, things they can get their hands on. And then, of course, threat actors can also target hosts they have identified that are not monitored, you know, by your security team, don't have sufficient login, you know, leading to further unauthorized and undetected activity. So they can obviously spot, you know, what parts of the network are not being monitored particularly robustly. And I think the takeaway here is just it's critical to make sure you have that extended monitoring and protection across all your network assets and implement a really thorough and all-encompassing monitoring strategy to ensure high-risk assets like this are monitored. You do have that in place, because if you don't, then you could end up, you know, targeted by these particular groups that are going after these VPN vulnerabilities and otherwise target them in this way. Well, so a lot there to kind of divulge and dip into, but, you know, Mark, and from your perspective and particularly your role, you know, how can companies harden their virtual private networks from potential misuse like we've seen, you know, in this particular report?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good stuff that you kind of hit on as well. Like, you know, the first, like when we went into the COVID, you know, everything had to be done very quick, right? And when things have to be done quick, it's where you usually start finding, you know, corners being cut. And sadly, the corner that usually gets cut the most is security, right? Because it requires the most sort of configuration and it can be time consuming. So like securing or hardening your VPN from misuse, like configuration's a big thing. So like kicking off, looking at how your access is configured, like what sort of restrictions do you have in place, not only from like unauthorized external addresses or sources, but also seeing, you know, is there any restrictions in place for what resources can be accessed, what network resources can be accessed when someone's on a VPN connection. You know, looking at how do we manage local or disabled accounts. You know, you mentioned password spraying as a vector. You know, one thing that we also see, especially with like poor configuration, is usage of default accounts. You know, a lot of these default accounts are more than readily available. You know, you would hope that at least the password has been changed, but we have seen instances in which it's just out of the box and it's only meant to be used to get all the other accounts set up and then disabled, locked down, can't be used. So making sure that, you know, any disabled local accounts are cleaned up where necessary, checking out VPN profiles, what encryption levels are being leveraged, you know, are there things that we should be sort of bumping up, making sure that nothing kind of goes stale in the way the VPN gateways are configured. From a process standpoint, you know, I'm going to say patch management. And I know you mentioned that, you know, we're kind of being repetitive, but I think to me, like, repetition's the key to mastery. So the reason why we keep repeating these things is because it's the basic stuff that needs to be done right. Otherwise, all your, you know, more advanced solutions and processes, they're gonna just fall. It's like a house of cards. So obviously the patch management side of things, but from a process perspective as well, like when you look at VPN authentication, you can add multiple different mechanisms. You can look at MFA. You could look at even doing authentication based on the certificate that's on the device to leverage as a sort of a second trust point, and making sure that you're testing these controls consistently. You know, testing and kind of, you know, seeing where you can be hurt. You know, we go into these purple team exercises, these red team exercises. A lot of organizations do them internally. Some, you know, outsource it. But I think as long as you do that in some capacity, you should be sort of halfway there. And then finally, if obviously the preventative controls end up failing, which, you know, at times they will, and you have to be prepared for that. you got to have some degree of detective measures in place. So, you know, as Chris mentioned, you know, make sure that you are logging all of the different devices, all the different gateways in some, you know, SIM solution, data lake, whichever is more preferable to the organization, and making sure that you have, you know, the rules in place, an incident response plan that can be kicked off for containment and remediation if some activity is observed that's, you know, anomalous or malicious. And that's going to kind of bring you to a decent spot. And then from there, you know, you can kind of evaluate again where you're standing from a VPN security standpoint.
Just getting the logging and the monitoring of these devices is the biggest thing to do right from the get-go. You're going to spot suspicious activity so in such more regularity. And then obviously you're not in this position where you're trying to patch before the horse has bolted, so to speak. So yeah, that's a really, really, really good summation of how to tackle this particular issue.
Like a quick thing on the logging, like there's so many times, even during, you know, Purple Team exercises that customers go through where we didn't fire an alert for something and it becomes like an analysis of, you know, what happened. And a lot of the times it's, you know, we weren't logging this particular area of the network, or this logging wasn't turned on, or this particular event wasn't being forwarded. So making sure that you have adequate logging is almost as crucial as making sure all the protective configurations are in place. Just want to throw that in there.
Stop it earlier in the tracks. Yeah, so you're not having to turn a detection into a remediation later on. That's a good point. Let's move on to the last topic for today. So for those who don't remember, I'm sure you probably do, to be fair, but the Change Healthcare platform, which is owned by United Health Group subsidiary Optum, they were breached by the Alfie Black Cat, also known as Black Cat, ransomware group back in February of this year. That caused widespread operational outages and obviously the risk of sensitive patient and client data being breached. A $22 million payment, a ransom payment, was allegedly made by Optum. And this was kind of supported by blockchain transaction records associated with Alfie, and apparently was stolen by the ransomware as a service program for Alfie in an exit scam, which is quite interesting. So essentially they posted a fake takedown, like poster, if you like, from that was originally posted on their data leak site in last year when they were targeted by, I believe the FBI led this particular operation. And they posted on this on the data leak site saying, oh, we've been taken down by, you know, law enforcement. And then they sort of went underground, and it turned out that this was just like a fake. And they were doing it to sort of scam their affiliate or affiliates who conducted this particular attack against Optum Change out of the $22 million ransom payment. So, you know, like that old adage is, you know, you can't trust a thief, and all those sorts of Sanders sayings that come about, you know. Yeah, there you go. That's who you're working with, ransomware operators. Now, the latest developments are that Change have been targeted in a secondary incident, this time by the Ransom Hub Group, who have reportedly begun to start leaking the data. So obviously they paid a ransom fee, and now they're being targeted by a secondary group, which is something we have seen before, you know, companies paying ransom and then they get extorted again, which probably says a lot around the you know, the whole point of paying ransom fees. You know, if you do it once, you're almost giving them the incentive to target you again, really. But yeah, so this time it's the ransom group extorting Change. So Mark, and what do we know of Ransom Hub and this particular operation?
Yeah, so Ransom Hub's relatively new in a relatively new threat actor group in the whole ransomware game or ransomware landscape. Their first victim posting was in February 2024. Since that, they've claimed an additional 17 targets, but only really veiled 14 of them. So they might still be in the process of direct communication for extortion before posting it on the leak site. But in terms of what we know about them, so they actually give quite a lot of information on their own about page. So they claim to have members across the globe and state that they are solely motivated by financial gain. There's no political, no sort of activism involved. It's just purely financial, which makes sense that they're going into ransomware. They have also included some targets that they've prohibited from being targeted by themselves or any affiliates. A lot of them are Cuba, North Korea, China, and a lot of the Commonwealth of Independent States. So the Russia.
Is it Kazakh countries? No. I'm thinking of something else.
The CIS.
Thank you. The common, yes.
Yeah, Commonwealth of Independent States. Yeah. So yeah. Russia and a bunch of the other like Eurasian Soviet Union.
The former Soviet countries.
Yeah. So they have sort of prohibited those from being targeted. And interestingly, they've also mentioned that nonprofit organizations shouldn't be targeted, which kind of makes me think, like, are they trying to give that whole, and I know we've talked about it before, like, but given this kind of like Robin Hood vibe, like, we have some conscience behind us. So it's interesting to see that. And they even offer free decryptors for any of these organizations, or if you've been like double dipped by an affiliate, so if you're being re-attacked. From an MO point of view, so their operations actually resemble a lot the traditional Russian ransomware setup. It also coincides with their exclusion list. They offer collaboration with their affiliates. And the way they actually do it, which is an interesting point as well, is so the Ransom Hub group will request 10% of any proceedings made from a campaign that's launched by its affiliates. But the way they take the payment is that they allow the affiliate to receive the whole money first, and then after the fact receive the 10%. So this is actually something that's regarded very highly within the ransomware community, because typically you would have the operators taking the cut and then giving the affiliates the money. And it kind of also ties into that whole Alpha V Black Cat tie for this to be Ransom Hub, because, you know, after the whole exit scam, you know, you could definitely make an assumption that this could be them just trying to rebrand and resume operations as normal, but also kind of shed that negative reputation that they got after that exit scam. But yeah, most of their recruiting is coming from a Ramp forum, where they get, which is heavily Russian, mostly Russian people. And they claim that their strain is just like a rewritten ESXi strain using Golang as the language. Talking about the tie more, so obviously, you know, there's theories around Alpha V and Ransom Hub being the same, but I think what's a more likely scenario is that when Alpha V Black Cat sort of went down, quote unquote, what they probably ended up doing was a lot of their partners and affiliates just ended up moving to Ransom Hub. So you effectively have a lot of the key members part of this new group, but it may not be as simple as just a complete rebrand, because looking at some of the evidence, like the leak site for Ransom Hub did come out before the whole exit scam with Alpha V, so it looks like they were at times two separate entities, which they've also claimed, of course. But yeah.
That is fascinating, the distinction between the way they pay their affiliates. Like, I had no idea about that. So
yeah, it's actually against the norm for most operators. Yeah. So
usually you pay the developers, they give you a cutback. In this case, the affiliate who's actually doing the hard work, let's be honest, receives all the payment and then gives some of it back to the developers for leasing their program. That is fascinating. Yeah. I didn't realize about that. And again, it kind of alludes to, you know, if they were going to branch off from Alfie and they'd been stung in this exit scam, that's one of the things they probably would want to introduce to ensure that that doesn't happen to them again. So that's really interesting. I do like the reference you made to Robin Hood as well. Like, as someone who's from Nottingham, so the listeners are learning something about me now, I'm pretty sure he gave some of the money back to like poor people, apparently, according to the cartoon in the movie. But he actually existed. Anyway, Robin Hood, maybe not. So last week we mentioned there was a tenuous link, the link we made really, between the Optum breach and a wave of kind of social engineering attacks targeting healthcare companies. Do you think there's any possibility in that? So it's a bit of a stretch, but you know, Ransom Hub, Alfie are now like leaking the data. They've probably almost certainly monetized it as much as possible in selling it onto interested third parties, and there would be a lot of those. So do you think there's any sort of link between that social engineering campaign and breach?
Obviously, confidence levels in like direct links are always going to be difficult unless you've got clear proof. But I think there's definitely a likelihood of it being the case, because even in some of the previous spotlights we've done, you know, people listening and even people who read our reports, you may be surprised at how often threat actors have started to utilize sources for kind of sidestepping some of that initial compromise details that they would need. So using like initial access brokers for credentials at an organization, or trying to bribe members within an organization to give them access. So you can see that threat actors are starting to leverage some of their own money to kind of, I guess, elevate their chances of success when conducting their own campaigns. So it's definitely very feasible that some threat actors have paid for some of this data beforehand and to sort of kickstart their own campaigns and sort of go with that social engineering vector to begin with. But again, like direct ties, it'll be difficult to ascertain that for sure.
We don't know at this stage, but like you said, it's the curve of success, isn't it? It's like when you're investing and you make your first 100,000, whatever that might be, it's so much easier to then turn that into a million or turn that into more money. It's the same with these threat actors. If they can have a modicum of success, they can then build upon that and then use that profit that they've achieved to, I guess, conduct the next campaign, whatever it might be. So I know we've been going for about 40 minutes now, so I'll just briefly before we wrap up, just to mention some tips for responding to this particular breach. I'll just quickly mention my perspective is that, you know, obviously one breach can kind of spiral out of control very quickly and turn into something else. You know, if you have a compromised entity with existing connections, if discovered, attackers can use that to sort of pivot elsewhere. Something Caroline mentioned on the podcast when we talked about this recently, with regards to Optum, you know, that you can see these breaches turn into something, you know, quite much more significant. So you start with one smaller entity, and then obviously they're moving laterally into, you know, partner organizations. The likes of Scattered Spider that we've seen, Alfie, now redundant, apparently. They've been associated with these sorts of downstream attacks before, so that can happen. And then I think just with the Optum breach specifically, just if you have any connectivity to these to this organization, just making sure to rotate credentials, conduct your own investigation, search logs since that February breach and potentially before that as well, if you can go back that far. And then obviously the actual breach itself came about from exploitation of the ConnectWise vulnerability. So, you know, making sure that that gets patched, not just for this, but other threat actors that will be targeting that one. Yeah, I think that's the main things, really. Any final thoughts from you, Markin?
Yeah, I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head for this particular one. You know, with ransomware, there's always going to be like the standard stuff with backups. But yeah, I think you covered on a lot of the good points.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll exit there. So thank you so much, Markin, for joining me today. Really a fascinating discussion. I certainly enjoyed it. Listeners, if you found this podcast insightful, by all means, give us a like, subscribe on your respective podcasting platform. Tell some of your work colleagues, a friend. We're always on the hunt for new listeners. Other than that, stay safe and we'll see you next week.